Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and in a conventional view, democracy begins with the voters. Ordinary people have preferences about what their government should do, and they choose leaders who will do those things, or they enact their preferences directly in referendums. My next guest says that's the dream of democracy, but we are living in a very, very different reality. Larry Bartels, political scientist, Vanderbilt University professor, and co-author of Democracy for Realists, Why Elections Do Not Produce Responsive Governments, joins us now. He's also the author of the newly updated Unequal Democracy, The Political Economy of the New Gilded Age. We'll get his take on the state of our democracy now and how the choice between Clinton and Trump reflects his ideas. Welcome to WNYC, Professor Bartels. Thanks for coming on with us.
Hi, thank you.
You write, the ideal of popular sovereignty plays the same role in contemporary democratic ideology that the divine right of kings played in the monarchical era. Really, aren't they the opposite?
Well, they're the opposite in terms of content, but they're similar in the sense that they're both highly idealized justifications for a system that operates quite differently than the justification would suggest. And so our argument is that we want to get below the what we call the folk theory of democracy and understand how the actual working of democratic systems contrasts with the way we'd like to think about them.
To go to the title of your book, do you think elections do not produce responsive governments?
We do. There are some good things about democracy, obviously. It has real virtues, but we think the virtues get obscured by focusing on this unrealistic idea that ordinary citizens can somehow steer the ship of state from the voting booth.
For example?
Well, we imagine that citizens are voting on the basis of all kinds of issues and choosing the candidates who will implement the policies that they prefer. One problem with that is that most citizens don't have real preferences about most of the policies that the government will have to wrestle with once it's in power. The ideas that they do have about policy are mostly ones that they've adopted from their preferred politicians rather than being a basis for preferring those politicians in the first place. And as a result, the main justification of elections in democratic theory, that citizens can discipline candidates to choose positions that reflect the will of the public, really doesn't pan out very well. If you look at the positions of actual elected officials or the positions of presidential candidates, you find that they're often quite far from what you'd expect if they were being driven by the preferences of the pivotal voters in the middle of the ideological distribution. So people mostly just aren't voting on the basis of those kinds of considerations.
Do you think the problem is largely that the elected officials are responsive to two competing sets of Americans? One is the voters who put them into office, and the other is the donors from the donor class with deep enough pockets, and they're the special interests?
Well, there's an idea that the donors and the party base are somehow pulling the candidates away from the center of the population at large. I think there's something to that, but actually if you look at the relationship between the preferences of the party bases as best we can measure them and what their presidential candidates stand for, that relationship isn't as strong as you might imagine, and often it turns out that the candidates are even more extreme than their own bases. So I think it has more to do with the ideological convictions of the political elites themselves and the fact that they aren't really very disciplined by the electorate to adopt moderate positions.
That's interesting that you say the elected officials are often more extreme than their voting bases. There's a column by Ross Douthat, conservative columnist in The Times today, musing on why Trump is the nominee. And he lays it at the feet of Republican leaders who have failed to control the populist passions of the base. In other words, he felt that Republican elected officials are generally elected by people who are more passionately right-wing than they are, and the elected officials try to temper that populism once they get into office. I guess you see it the other way.
Well, it varies from issue to issue, but I think the important point about Trump from our perspective is that it seems pretty clear that people are not supporting him primarily because of his policy positions. It wasn't the case that millions of people all over the country really wanted a wall built along the southern border, and Trump came along and fulfilled that policy preference. Rather, they were attracted to Trump for a variety of other reasons. He was talking about building the wall, and a lot of people said, yeah, that's probably a good idea.
And your central argument seems to be that people primarily vote their social, religious, and political identities, not their ideas or their policy preferences. So, for example, with Clinton and Trump and taxes, you'd say that voters who found Trump's tax message persuasive gravitated toward him, but those who liked Clinton's plan gravitated toward her. And this is a view in which people's policy beliefs come first and their political allegiances follow naturally, but that's not what's happening. Is that your position?
Right. It's mostly the other way around. There was a nice study by a political scientist named Gabriel Lenz who looked at the issue of Social Security privatization back in the 2000 campaign. That was a big issue. A lot of the ads and the rhetoric in the last weeks of the campaign focused on that issue. And if you looked over time at the relationship between people's preference on that issue and their presidential vote intentions, that relationship became substantially stronger. So the conventional interpretation of that fact is that people had preferences on these issues and they figured out which candidate shared their preferences and voted for that candidate. But what Lenz did was to look in detail at the responses of the same people in surveys over time and found that the increasing relationship between their issue preferences and their vote intentions was almost entirely due to the fact that people who already preferred Bush learned his position on the issue and adopted it as their own. People who preferred Gore learned about his position and adopted it as their own. And almost nobody actually changed their vote intentions on the basis of their preferences about that issue.
Listeners, do you think democracy works in reality as you think it does in theory, or as you used to think it does in theory? Are you learning new, either disillusioning or maybe encouraging things about democracy through this election cycle? Give us a call. For Larry Bartles from Vanderbilt University and co-author of Democracy for Realists, Why Elections Do Not Produce Responsive Governments, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Your international comparison is really interesting. You cite surveys showing the overwhelming majority of Americans say living in a democracy is absolutely important, but you point out that perceptions of democratic reality were surprisingly robust in unlikely places like Rwanda, Malaysia, and Kazakhstan. Even the Chinese respondents were indistinguishable from Americans, not just in their enthusiasm for democracy, but also in their assessment for how democratically their own country is being governed. How do you explain that?
Well, I think it's an indication of how broad the allegiance to the idea of democracy is, but also how vague the idea is. So all these very different political systems can call themselves democracies and convince their citizens that to a greater or lesser extent they live up to the ideals of democracy, whatever those might be. But what's striking to us is that that's just as true in lots of other places as it is in the United States. Americans are not out of line with the global average in terms of either their commitment to democracy as an ideal or to the sense that they have of the gap between the actual practice of democracy and that ideal.
And Americans have cognitive dissonance about the issue. For example, the majority of Americans say that democratic government is a very important factor in the nation's success, but also believe the government is run by a few big interests. Can you talk more about how that cognitive dissonance, or as you say, schizophrenic view, is sustained? Is there a tipping point?
Well, I don't think we're anywhere near a tipping point. I think the idea of democracy is so elastic that it's probably difficult to convince people that there isn't something good about it that they can somehow pursue. But what we think is dangerous is that the connection between those ideals and the real problems of any political system may be quite tenuous. So by trying to pursue an unrealistic idea, we may miss opportunities to reform the system in ways that are practically more important and more likely to be successful.
And it's a progressive adage that the cure for the ills of democracy is more democracy. But you say the practice of direct democracy, institutional reforms intended to enhance the role of the ordinary citizen, does not solve the inherent problems of democracy. And you use the election of 1970 as an example. What happened then?
I'm not sure what you mean about 1970.
There was an example. Well, maybe I'm confusing. Well, here's another one that I'm more familiar with.
There was a reform of the presidential nomination process in response to the events of the 1968 election. We basically opened up the system and added lots of primaries and made it harder for party elites to control the nomination.
Well, that's today's nominating system.
Right. So if you look at what happened in 2016 on the Republican side, the party elites were, although they were not very unified in terms of their positive preferences, were quite unified in thinking that Donald Trump was not the person who should be the Republican nominee. But they lost control of the system to this plurality of Republican primary voters who gave them Trump despite their best efforts.
Another example of the inherent flaw of direct democracy that you cite comes in 2009 in Illinois, when voters in one area seized the opportunity to curtail fire district budgets. That's such a hyperlocal example compared to how we nominate presidents. What happened there?
Well, the localities were given the option of forcing citizens to vote on increasing the budgets of their local fire districts. And a lot of citizens took the opportunity to cut their taxes by a few pennies by constraining the fire district budgets. That led to problems with the equipment and the training and increase in the time that it took these fire departments to respond to fires and an increase in the damage that was caused by fires, probably also an increase in people's insurance rates as a result. And so they probably ended up paying more in insurance than they saved in taxes. But thinking through all of those steps and realizing that it's a bad deal to try and save a little bit on your fire district budget isn't something that ordinary citizens are likely to be very good at.
Peter in Glen Ridge, you're on WNYC. Hi, Peter.
Hi. Thank you for the most intelligent discussion I've heard all political season.
Thank you.
and you were touching on what I was going to bring up, which was that the primary system, as it started, and please, I know you can elaborate on this, that was started, I guess it was the 1960s, to replace the smoke-filled room, what that allowed for was the infiltration of outsiders with marginal ideas, basically the corruption of the party, the dilution of the brand name. They couldn't protect their brand name, whether Republican or Democrat. But I just, because I was born in 63, so I really don't know about it. But the thing about the smoke-filled room, where a party could say, look, here's who we want to put forward. Here's who we want to put in the Super Bowl, not leave it open to anyone to infiltrate. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, there were real problems with the old system in terms of its ability to respond to shifts in public needs, possibility at least of the political elites monopolizing control of the political system in ways that were unhealthy. Our basic attitude is that in almost every respect, what democracy needs is both some popular input and some control or basically guidance from people who are professional politicians and pay close attention to what's going on and have a real career interest in things going well. So our idea is not that we should leave everything to the elites all the time, but that we need some sensible balance between the role of the elites and the role of the masses, rather than simply imagining that if we put ordinary people in charge, things are going to go well.
Why not think that if we put ordinary people in charge, and I just mean of the electoral process, that things will go well over the long term? Because if, let's say, a populist Republican plurality nominates Donald Trump and he turns out to get creamed in the election results or even becomes president and is horrible at it, that then the democratic process will self-correct. People will get turned off from that kind of candidate and won't nominate or elect one again, at least for a generation when people have memory of it, rather than leaving it more to the elites who have their own interests, which might continue to disadvantage people forever and ever.
Well, there are at least two problems with that way of thinking about it. One is that the damage in the meantime can be very substantial. And the other is that it's often very hard for people to figure out what the problem is and what caused it and how it can be corrected. So, for example, there's been a lot of talk lately about gridlock in the American political system and how frustrated people are by the fact that government can't seem to get anything done. But ordinary people's ability to control that through this complicated mix of elections for different people for different offices at different times is really quite limited. Many Americans don't know which party controls Congress, and so it's unlikely that they're going to be able to make a very sophisticated judgment about the way members of Congress have contributed to either solving or not solving the country's problems.
We just have 30 seconds left, but the alternative to that view, I've heard many times from George Will, for example, who says, we have gridlock not as a byproduct of some malfunction of our democracy, but by design, because the people keep choosing to elect Democratic presidents and Republican Congresses or vice versa.
Well, they do that. It's not obvious that their intention is to create gridlock by doing that. There are some people who are fans of gridlock, but I think many more people are upset about gridlock and think that the government should be doing more. Of course, the problem is that we all disagree about what the more is that we want the government to do.
Larry Bartles, political scientist, Vanderbilt University professor, and co-author now of Unequal Democracy, also author of the newly updated Unequal get your two book titles right. The old one is Unequal Democracy, right?
Yes.
The Political Economy of the New Gilded Age, which is updated with a section on the Obama years. And the new book is Democracy for Realists, Why Elections Do Not Produce Responsive Governments. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.